for the non-initiated. I'll go into what is chameleon gravity, and I'll be focusing on what is the chameleon state in the early universe, and what are these kicks? What exactly is doing the kicking, and why is it important? That'll bring me to kind of a classical treatment of the kicks, and I'll go into how these kicks get the chameleon moving at very high speed, and where it takes the chameleon. It takes it to a rather unpleasant place where the effect of quantum mechanics become important. And that'll be the third part of my talk on quantum chameleon kicks, i.e. why do rapid changes in the mass of the chameleon generate perturbations in the chameleon field, and what kind of perturbations we can expect, and why the chameleon ends up in very, very deep trouble. So to start our chameleon cosmology crash course, let's just start with a cartoon picture of what is chameleon gravity. It's a scalar tensor gravity theory, which means, like all scalar tensor theories, the major challenge is we have to hide the scalar so that we don't have any fifth forces. And chameleon gravity does that by making the scalar's mass dependent on its environment. So the chameleon is governed by an effective potential that has a bare component, shown here, that's usually of a that's always of a runaway form, and then it picks up a coupling to matter that gives a effective minimum of this effective potential that in low density environments is out here, so the chameleon is light, and if this is uplifted, it can behave basically like lambda. But in a high density environment, like inside a galaxy, the effective potential, the matter coupling is much higher, the chameleon's pinned in a much more high curvature region, the mass is heavier, and the fat chameleon behaves like general relativity. And this is how chameleon gravity evades solar system tests. So now let's get into the nuts and bolts of the theory. Here's the action in the Einstein frame. So in the Einstein frame, it's just normal gravity, Einstein-Hilbert action, with a minimally coupled scalar field. But the matter Lagrangian depends on a different metric, the so-called Jordan frame metric, that is conformally related to the Einstein frame metric via the chameleon field and some coupling constant. Now, in both frames, we can treat the density as a perfect fluid, but then the densities and pressures in the Jordan frame are related to the densities and pressure in the Einstein frame by the same kind of conformal scaling. We also assume FRW in both metrics. Yes? Wow. I know there have been efforts to embed chameleon gravity into some kind of higher energy theory. I do not think that was its original motivation in any sense. Its original motivation was as a mechanism to screen a fifth force. So the answer, that's an incomplete answer to your question. But yeah, its main motivation is as a way to modify gravity and not have fifth forces. We have a Friedmann-Robertson-Walker metric in both frames, which means the scale factor in the Jordan frame is conformally related to the scale factor in the Einstein frame, as is proper time. And I'll be talking about this chameleon coupling constant beta a lot, the beta that appears here. Beta is usually taken to be of order unity, but in laboratory experiments, they're looking for values of beta more like 10,000. It's a relatively free parameter. And if you're familiar with F of R gravity, that corresponds to beta of 1 over root 6. So if we vary this action with respect to the Einstein metric, we pick up the usual Einstein equations sourced by both the Einstein frame stress energy tensor and the stress energy tensor for the scalar field. The chameleon's equation of motion picks up its usual derivative with respect to its bare potential, plus a coupling to the trace of the stress energy tensor, rho minus 3p. This is where the effective potential comes from, that the effective potential is the bare potential plus a linear piece that goes as density. And this is the root of the chameleon's crowning accomplishment, which is the thin shell mechanism. Imagine you have a massive body. Inside the body, the density is high, so the chameleon is pinned up here, and it's massive. Outside the body, the density is low, so the minimum is here, and it's light. Assuming that the difference between these minima is not too large, what happens is that the chameleon inside the body gets trapped up here, and because it's so massive, it's a short-range force, and so information about the interior of the body cannot propagate to the exterior of the surface, and the fifth force is only sourced by a tiny thin shell right at the boundary of the body. It's heavily suppressed, and this is how chameleons evade solar system tests. I won't be talking much about thin shell at all for the rest of this talk, because I'll be mostly focused in the early universe when there were no compact objects, but I want to highlight that it's a necessary and required feature of the chameleon that it has this kind of form of potential that it has a very steep part and then a shallow part. That's what makes the thin shell work. That's what makes the chameleon viable. You can't evade that. So now let's look more specifically at what this chameleon potential is. Here's kind of the fiducial form that's been around since the chameleon was first proposed in 2004. It has a mass scale that's determined by the requirements to evade solar system tests, and also just happens to be the dark energy scale. So this created a lot of excitement that here we have something that to evade solar system tests naturally gives you the exact scale of dark energy, and this should be our chameleon potential. So just to get a kind of handle for how this potential evolves, let's consider, where is the chameleon now? So in kind of the cosmic background density level, the minimum of the effective potential is out at 10 to the 9 m. Really big, out here in the flat part, but much, much less than M Planck. And since the density today is as low as the density has ever been, the minimum is actually always less, much, much less than M Planck.
Am I supposed to keep this seriously near zero?
You are supposed to take it at least seriously as you need to go up to get the successful thin shell mechanism. And there was a recent paper by Justin Curry, Wayne Hu, and I think one of their students that looked into the Coleman-Weinberg corrections to this potential, given how far you have to go up, like shield neutron stars, et cetera. And it is a little concerning. I think after today, you'll find that that's the least of chameleon's problems. This is fairly insensitive to beta. This is beta of order one. This was mainly just postulated to give the thin shell mechanism. This is the form of the potential that you need to get the thin shell mechanism and screen the force. So inside the galaxy, the density is a little higher. The minimum is now at 10 to the 7 m, and we're still much on the flat part of the potential. To get onto the steep part of the potential, phi less than m, that happens inside the sun, inside the Earth, and at temperatures greater than 2 MeV, when the matter density is much, much higher. So now we need to talk about where is the chameleon field initially. This is a little bit of a heuristic discussion, exactly because of your question, Keith. We don't really want to trust this potential up to the energies required to make this argument robust. But kind of our cartoon argument would be that during inflation, the trace of the stress energy density is huge. And so during inflation, you'd expect the chameleon to be pinned way up high, somewhere up here. Then the universe reheats, and all that energy goes into radiation. The trace of the stress energy tensor rapidly falls. The floor basically gets ripped out from under the chameleon, and it goes into some kind of free fall. It's a free-falling chameleon. It hits the minimum of its effective potential with a considerable velocity. And you can use the equation of motion out in the regime where you can neglect the bare potential to calculate exactly how far out it will roll given some initial velocity at Feynman. And it turns out to be something on order of the Planck mass, where this is the fraction of the universe's energy initially in the chameleon kinetic energy. Once it gets out here, it gets stuck. Because the chameleon's very light, radiation is still giving a very high Hubble constant, so Hubble friction basically pins it out here. And so there was a concern way back from the beginning that this could give problems, that the chameleon ends up stuck way out on its matter branch, and has no way of reaching home because of Hubble friction, at least until the universe becomes matter-dominated. And this is really concerning, because we don't think that phi can vary much between now and BBN. And that's because if you look in the Einstein frame, all of the particle masses depend on phi. And so if phi changes significantly between now and BBN, this is going to mess up all of our BBN predictions. And so the general rule of thumb has always been that the chameleon at BBN had better be less than about 10% M Planck divided by beta, so that these effects are about less than 10%. There's never been a truly rigorous calculation of what's required, but this is kind of the general rule of thumb if you want to be safe. And so this was a major concern right from the beginning, was that how do we get the chameleon home in time for BBN? And again, from the beginning, there was the idea that we can unstick the chameleon. If you look at particles in thermoequilibrium, I've got the Jordan frame density here and Jordan frame pressure as a function of their distribution functions. You see that if the mass truly is negligible, of course the pressure is 1/3 the density. But the mass here enters into the density and pressure in different ways. So as the mass becomes more important, the pressure receives corrections that actually mean it decreases faster than the density decreases. So the trace of the stress energy tensor, which I define as this sigma function, my kick function, is just the trace of the stress energy tensor divided by the density, starts to increase as the temperature of the universe cools. Now then, once the particles become truly heavy, they're Boltzmann suppressed, and the density goes down again. But this means that we see that sigma picks up kind of a peak every time a particle transitions from relativistic to non-relativistic. Aidan, did you have a question? So the trace of the stress energy tensor gets this kind of peak form every time a particle, every time the temperature is approximately equal to the mass of a particle. And that kick form goes right into the equation of motion for the chameleon. So basically, every time a particle transitions from being relativistic to non-relativistic, the chameleon potential momentarily becomes much steeper, and the chameleon can start to roll. These are the kicks that will kick the chameleon. Nathan, did you want to? So the mass during the kicks, the mass of the chameleon field is on the order of about 100 GeV, which means if you want to keep the chameleon in its minimum, you've got to cook it so that the decay rate is less than 100 GeV, so that the decay rate is always smaller than the mass so the chameleon can respond adiabatically. So that's a very, very, very slow decay rate and a low reheat temperature. Most of the story I'm telling won't be applicable because none of these kicks happened in that way. So maybe one way to possibly save the chameleon would be to possibly to reheat temperature until GeV or below.
100 GeV.
Well, yes, 100 GeV or below. Yeah. Although, as you can see here, the kicks start at about 100 GeV, but they don't stop. The kicks from the standard model come in kind of four combo kicks. The first being contributions from the heavy gauge bosons, the top quark, and the Higgs. Then we get the contribution from charm, bottom, and tau. Then there's a discontinuity at the QCD phase transition, which fortunately falls between kicks, so it doesn't affect us too much. We can just put it in by hand. Then you get a kick from mu and the pions. And then finally, a kick from the positrons and electrons. And the point is that BBN actually starts here. So there is a kick right during BBN, between proton-neutron freeze-out and the production of light elements. Also note that the kicks dominate over any contribution from the dark matter for all temperatures greater than about 0.02 MeV. So I won't really need to talk about dark matter again for the rest of the seminar. And during the kicks, the minimum of the effective potential is actually less than M. But, of course, we're assuming the chameleon is stuck far away from that minimum. So the old story, the chameleon gospel, is that the kicks save the chameleon, because the kicks will move the chameleon by order M Planck prior to BBN. And I show this with a numerical solution here. The blue curve shows phi over M Planck. It's initially stuck at, say, 0.4 here. And then every time, I've also plotted sigma on the same time axis here, every time there's a kick, the chameleon gets to roll a little bit, and then it stops. Then there's another kick, and the chameleon gets to roll some more. And then there's another kick, the chameleon gets to roll some more, and by BBN, it's moved of order beta of M Planck. The old calculation neglected the back reaction of phi, and we're going to see that's important. So the only old calculation is really only valid for beta squared less than 1, but it really relaxes this requirement on the initial condition. Now we can have any initial condition we want of order M Planck, and the kicks will bring us home in time for BBN. This then seemed to put the chameleon on solid footing. For a wide range of initial conditions, the chameleon will reach its minimum, the minimum of its effective potential, and then once it's there, it can happily stay there for the rest of its evolution. But I'm here to tell you that there is no happily ever after for the chameleon. The standard calculation misses several really important features. First, as I mentioned before, ignoring this feedback greatly underestimates the motion of the chameleon for all models of beta greater than about 1.8. What we'll see is that nearly all chameleons not only reach the minimum of their effective potential, they reach it with a considerable velocity. And that's a problem, because then they're going to start climbing their bare potential and rebound out. And I'll be able to show that the classical picture at that point is woefully incomplete, because the rebound is violent enough to excite quantum perturbations in the field. So that will be the part 2 and part 3. OK, let's start classically kicking chameleons now. So let's go back to the equation of motion for the chameleon. And I'm going to make some simplifications to put it in a more useful form. I'm going to change time variables to work with the logarithm of the Einstein frame scale factor and work in a dimensionless chameleon divided by M Planck. And in these units, this phi prime is actually just related to the fraction of cosmic energy in the kinetic energy of the chameleon field. I'm going to assume that phi is stuck way out away from its minimum and neglect the bare potential entirely. It's not important here. I'll also remind you that, like I mentioned, the matter density is much, much less than sigma, which in turn is always much, much less than 0.1. So I'm only going to keep linear order in sigma, and I'm going to neglect the matter entirely. And with those simplifications, I get this equation of motion for the chameleon field. Now, this equation is not closed by itself, because sigma here, the kick function, depends on the Jordan frame temperature. And the Jordan frame temperature can be computed in the usual way in the Jordan frame, shown here. But then when you go into the Einstein frame, because of the scaling between A twiddle and A star, you pick up a phi dependence. So the Jordan frame depends on phi as well. And the old story just set this to 1. But keeping the full expression for the Jordan frame temperature reveals a rather surprising possibility. If we take as our ansatz phi depending just linearly on the logarithm of the Einstein frame scale factor, we see that the Jordan frame temperature is actually constant. OK, that's cute. But it gets really more interesting when we note that this ansatz also solves the equation of motion. If phi prime is constant, phi double prime goes away, these factors cancel. And this is a solution provided that beta equals 1 over 3 sigma for some temperature. And remember that the temperature is fixed in the Jordan frame. So once this is satisfied, it will always be satisfied. You'll see. You'll see. So we call this the surfing solution. And the reason we call it a surfing solution is what basically happens is that the Jordan frame cools until the special surfing temperature is reached that satisfies this criterion. And then the chameleon rides this little wave here all the way to the minimum. Now, this solution only exists if there is a special temperature that satisfies this relation. And that turns into a lower bound on beta. So beta greater than about 3 is required to surf the first kick. Beta greater than 2.74 is required to surf the second kick. And then beta greater than about 2 for the third and the fourth kick. Now, it's neat that this... Yes, the fourth kick is the electron. Now, it's neat that this solution exists, but is it ever realized? And numerically, we can confirm that, yes, indeed, chameleons that can surf do surf. And I have to pause here and say I absolutely love Google Images because I put in surfing chameleons on a whim, and what do you know, Google actually provided. So here's a cartoon picture of the phase diagrams that we can find for this. Assuming that the initial velocity isn't too high, i.e. that it doesn't dominate the universe, the chameleon always finds its way onto this surfing solution with constant phi prime. Numerically, you can see an example here. Here I'm showing phi over phi prime. And you can see that phi is initially stuck, as expected, as the Jordan frame temperature cools, until the Jordan frame temperature reaches the magical surfing temperature for this value of beta, at which point phi quickly falls into its constant velocity solution, and the Jordan frame temperature just pauses. So you can think that basically the Jordan frame just waits until the scalar reaches the minimum of effective potential and the solution is no longer valid. Now, the surfing solution implies that each value of beta greater than 1.82, the minimum required to surf the final kick, reaches the minimum of its effective potential with a unique surfing velocity. Because the sigma during the surf is defined by 3 over beta squared, which defines the surfing temperature. Phi dot is related to phi prime times h, and phi prime in the surfing solution is just 1 over beta. Phi dot is then just related to beta and the radiation density in the Einstein frame. But at the end of the surf, since phi is much, much less than m Planck, the Einstein frame and the Jordan frame are about equivalent. So it's just given by the surfing temperature. And so we can plot as a function of beta what the surfing velocity is. And you see, it's really, really large. It's above 10 to the 4 GeV squared for chameleons that surf the first kick. Chameleons that surf the second kick go a little slower because they have to wait until the universe cools further before they can surf. And then you've got chameleons that surf the third kick. And then down here, there's a little sliver of chameleons that surf the final kick. So now we see that surfing chameleons always reach the minimum, and they reach it at high velocity. What about the chameleons that can't surf, beta less than 1.8? Well, for them, we have to go back to our equation of motion, which I've written now in a more provocative way as sigma. And we can integrate this twice and get an expression for delta phi. But I'll remind you that this isn't a closed expression because phi comes in here as well in determining the Jordan frame temperature, right, like that. Now, if the displacement of phi is small, much smaller than M Planck, you can just neglect this, and this was what was done earlier, and just integrate this up. And you find that the total displacement of from all four kicks is about minus 1.58 M Planck. And this works pretty well for beta less than about 0.7. But it underestimates delta phi for larger beta, because for larger beta, the motion of phi affects the Jordan frame temperature. So here I show in red what the kick function looks like as a function of Einstein frame time if you neglect the back reaction of phi on the temperature. And then blue is the full solution. So you see that the effect is that the kicks get drawn out, which means the kicks get more powerful, and they can move the chameleon further. And here's an example of that for like beta of 1.5. You still see about the same form that each kick moves the chameleon a certain amount, but the total displacement is much greater than predicted by just the linear relation. So here's the linear relation as a function of beta, and here's the total displacement. And you see that it diverges down. In some ways, the surfing solution can be considered the limit of this process, because the surfing solution takes this to infinity. So we see now that impact is nearly impossible to avoid. The first three kicks give a delta phi of about beta of m, beta times m Planck prior to BBM. The final kick moves you about half beta m Planck during BBM. So if we require that at BBN, the field's already fairly close to the minimum, for most values of beta, any beta greater than 0.42, the final kick is then guaranteed to slam you into the minimum. Smaller beta values can avoid the impact, but only if their initial condition is perfectly tuned so that all the sum total of all kicks, standard model and otherwise, bring it perfectly to the right position, that then the standard model kicks will move it exactly short of the minimum. So it's a pretty finely tuned condition. Normally, the chameleon just falls into its minimum and goes black. That's part three. What is splat? So, to put this in terms of the chameleon parameters, the coupling constant beta and the initial value of the chameleon, phi over m Planck, we see that the chameleon velocities are indeed huge. So these are the chameleon velocities in units of GeV squared. And you can see that most of the time it's greater than at least 0.1 GeV squared and gets up to 10 to the 4 GeV squared very easily for beta greater than about 4. Higher values of beta are the surfing chameleons, extension of the surfing chameleons. They just continue to rise to higher and higher velocities. So we see that phi dot generically is on the order of GeV squared. And I'll remind you, that's much, much greater than m squared, the characteristic scale and the potential, which is 10 to the minus 24 GeV squared. So this hierarchy here is going to be the root of all the chameleon's troubles. I'll also note that adding particles will simply increase this story. It will just increase the chameleon velocity because the kicks will just become more frequent, more powerful. And so this is actually kind of a minimal case. These are just the particles we know about. Yes? Because these models, the ones that have GeV scale, are actually crashing far before BBM. They're crashing during like the first kick, which is happening at 100 GeV BBM. Okay. So remember, I showed that phi prime is actually root 6 omega kinetic energy. Phi prime here is 1 over beta. So yeah, it can be up to like 10%, 5% of the energy density, but always subdominant. And yeah, these things, these high energy guys are colliding well before BBM in the earlier kicks. So let's start by just considering the splat, and let's consider it classically. We go back to our potential. It's important again now, because we're cruising in to the minimum of the effective potential with a big velocity. So during the kicks, the minimum of the effective potential is actually, depending on which kick you're talking about, between 0.13 and 0.62 m. But the chameleon doesn't stop when it reaches there. It's moving too fast. It's going to climb up its potential until it exhausts all of its kinetic energy, and that's going to give a minimum of the effective potential that's much smaller, 0.08 to 0.11. And this is an exponential potential, so that's a big difference. For the rest of this talk, we're going to be focused on this impact, which means we're interested in displacements in the chameleon field much less than m, and times less than m over phi dot. This is a very short time scale. You can show that h star times this time scale is proportional to m over m Planck, so it's very, very small. I won't be talking about the expansion of the universe anymore for the rest of this treatment. You can go through and keep the expansion of the universe until the very end. It just makes the equations more messy. Also, Hubble friction plus the kicks over these kind of time scales, these displacements, give a totally negligible correction to phi dot. So the phi dot given to the field by the kicks when it reaches, you know, about here, does not change at all due to the kicks as the field moves of order m. So we can now neglect the matter coupling. It's not important anymore. And the bare potential dominates the second and the third derivative of the effective potential. So for the most, for the rest of this, we won't be really talking about the matter coupling at all. It's done its job. It's accelerated the chameleons to these high velocities, and now it kind of stands back. This is, by the way, one of the major challenges always faced when studying chameleons is this huge hierarchy of scales. We've approached this by a divide and conquer strategy, basically, that we can treat the regime where the matter is important and get a velocity from that, and then use that as an initial condition for a study of the actual bounce, the reflection, that then can be on a much smaller scale and not use the matter coupling. So classically, because Hubble friction has no time to act during this little bounce, this is just a reflection. The chameleon is going to roll up, roll back down, and roll out with exactly the same velocity it came in with. And this should make you nervous, because if you plot what the effective mass of the chameleon does during this process, the effective mass of the chameleon given by the square root of its second derivative of its bare potential spikes up to 10 to the 17 GeV in a very, very, very short time, and then comes back down as the chameleon classically runs up and runs back out. This is alarming, which brings me to part three, the quantum treatment of the chameleon kicks. So before I move on, any questions about the classical kicks and how we got these high velocities?
Set the initial conditions to come short. How close you do come up short of the minimum, how close do you have to be to violate? What's the main constraint then? The constraint from changing GU in between big bang and distances?
For that, you just need to be about 0.1 m Planck divided by beta. So these small values of beta, you're looking at about 0.2 m Planck. So it's close enough. But the minimum of the effective potential is way down at m. So there's a lot of actual room there that you can be OK with BBN and still be way, well away from the minimum of the effective potential. And it's those, I didn't explicitly say. So this white space down here are the chameleons that move far enough to satisfy the BBN constraint, but don't hit the minimum.
Okay, so
this white space here.
Those guys are okay with that particularly fine tuning initial condition.
So, like, if for this value of beta, you have to be between here, which is pretty fine tuned. For a really, really, really small value of beta, you're relaxed. But then I think you might run into problems with thin shell, because beta comes into the thin shell condition.
That's what I was going to ask, though. So is there some lower bound on beta from solar system?
That's an excellent question that I want to explore further. I don't have a good answer for that. It's very model dependent, unfortunately. And so I don't have a nice answer for that. But in general,
do you think it's at this kind of level?
Decreasing beta gets you in trouble with thin shell. If you just look at the thin shell condition, decreasing beta makes it harder and harder to achieve thin shell. I don't know the exact specifics of where down here the breakdown happens. F of R gravity, by the way, falls right at this line where it's beta's 0.1/√6, and so it's a very, 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 it's like a 0.01 window here that it can lie in. Okay, let's move on to quantum mechanics. Regimes you don't usually talk about in modified gravity. So, a quick review. We're worried because rapid changes in the effective mass of a field generate perturbations. And so I'm going to quickly go over why this happens. So we start with that chameleon equation in motion, and we throw away Hubble because it's not important for us anymore. We break the chameleon into a mean value and perturbations, and then write that perturbation as decompose it in terms of creation and annihilation operators, the standard way to quantize a scalar field. This leaves us with an equation of motion for the mode functions that has a time-dependent frequency, because the frequency is given by the second derivative of the bare potential, and the bare potential is changing as the chameleon rolls up and back down. It's the steep part. So the way to handle a time-dependent frequency is to express the mode functions in terms of Bogoliubov coefficients. kind of a WKB-like approximation, where we have alpha of t and beta of t with positive and negative frequency. This normalization, alpha squared minus beta squared equals 1, gives the desired commutation relations for the field. And then we define the occupation number of each mode as the energy in that mode divided by the energy per oscillator. And what we see, minus the vacuum contribution. And what we see then is the occupation number is directly related to beta squared. So what we call vacuum is beta equals 0, alpha equals 1. Now, this Bogoliubov expansion solves the mode equations provided that alpha and beta satisfy these coupled differential equations. And the key here is that beta dot is proportional to omega dot over omega. So we get particle production, beta greater than 1, when omega dot over omega squared is greater than 1. And for us, that's given by the third derivative of phi times the velocity. This is a big velocity. And I've plotted it here for 100 GeV squared velocity, kind of right in the middle of that contour plot I showed you, and K of 10 to the 16 GeV, nice high energy. And you can see that the classical solution tells you you should expect huge amounts of particle production. Omega dot over omega squared is reaching up to 5 during the climb up and the climb down. So from that, we then can calculate the energy in the perturbations. And when you write it in terms, this in terms of Bogoliubov coefficients, you find the energy is just integrated up over the occupation number. And so we define this energy, perturbation energy per logarithmic interval in K, E sub K, that's just related to the occupation number and in turn directly related to beta. And I'll be talking about that a fair amount. Now let's do a first estimate of what this particle production can give us for the chameleon. And the very naive first approximation you can do is say, wow, that looks kind of like a delta function. So let's put in a delta function for V double prime. If you do that, then it's just a simple matching condition problem to determine what beta is. And you find that beta is given by the amplitude of the delta function over k. So the occupation number is lambda squared over k squared. The energy is proportional to k squared. So wait, does that mean that infinitely high wave numbers are excited? Well, yes, by a delta function. But the real function actually has some non-zero width to it.
Sorry, how do you get from 1 over k squared to k squared?
Because E of k is basically k to the 4 times nk.
Why?
Because?
How you mean you the integral of your
And these are very relativistic, so omega is approximately k. So yes, a delta function excites infinitely high wave numbers, but with a realistic function that actually has some width, modes with wave numbers greater than this width will not be excited. These modes oscillate rapidly enough that to them, these mass changes, rapid as though they are still adiabatic. And so if you calculate something for a finite width, you find that it's cut off. So we can estimate what this width is, just classically, given basically how long does it take the field to have an order unity change in the second derivative of its potential. And you can solve that around the bounce point and get an estimate for the time. Duration. It's given by derivatives of the bare potential evaluated at the turnaround point, what I call the bounce point. Then you can estimate what lambda should be. So here's the expression for k peak, this 1 over t, delta t that you get from this estimate. And you'll notice it gets a phi dot over n. That's a big number. But let's soldier on and say now we need to know what lambda is. Well, lambda was the normalization of our delta function. So it should be given by basically the integral of v double prime over the bounds. So you calculate what that is, because the way the derivatives work out, it's also just related to this peak wave number. And then we can ask, how much energy did we have in perturbation at this peak wave number that we expect to be excited? And the answer is way too much. The energy in per logarithmic interval in K around the peak divided by the initial energy of the chameleon, just given by its initial kinetic energy, is proportional to V dot to phi dot over m squared squared. Remember that this was on the order of 10 to the 24. So this is huge. We've totally violated conservation of energy. And our naive estimate is telling us that, yeah, you get particles, but you get way, way, way too many of them. Yes?
I got a little confused as to how you computed particle production, because when people talk about the adiabatic vacuum, which is just this WKB approximation, so first order particle production is exponentially suppressed. So how, what makes it different in this case?
Because of the rapid changes in the effective frequency of the modes, that it's because that WKB approximation is only a solution if beta is proportional to omega dot over omega. So when you have rapid changes in the frequency, the particle production is no longer suppressed. It's excited.
Yeah, but then in that case, you can't use the adiabatic vacuum, right? The WKB approximation is only good when the frequencies.
But she's not using WKB approximation.
Exactly, when you're using WKB start to break, you get
then you get
I see. Okay.
So you start in vacuum, then you move to something not in vacuum because of the particle production.
I see.
And the naive estimate tells you you totally violate energy conservation, which means you've got to add in the back reaction of the perturbations back on to the classical trajectory. So we have to revisit the equation of motion for the chameleon and again split the field into background of perturbations. And then write down the full Taylor expansion for the background equation. And usually we throw away these terms. But when you take the spatial average, the even terms here, proportional to delta phi to even powers of n, actually don't vanish. So we keep the first term, the delta phi squared back reaction term. We do, however, throw everything else away. So it's not exact. This is a linear treatment with first-order back reaction.
Sorry, why would switch be average?
Because this is the equation for the background value. This is the equation for the background field. So we're going to take the spatial average of the equation. So with the linear perturbations with a first-order back reaction, we have a new background equation for the spatially averaged phi that gets a feedback term from the perturbations. We have our linearized mode equation, and then we can write the average delta phi squared in terms of the mode equations integrated over k. So this is not an exact system of equations. We drop interactions between the modes. We drop the higher order back reaction. But the one thing that you can show this system does for you is it's guaranteed to conserve energy. You can show that this system of equations guarantees that energy, any energy picked up in the perturbations is actually lost by the background field. So at least we won't run into our old problems. Now this is a closed system, so we can solve it numerically. And if I were in Star Trek, I could just say, hello, computer, please solve these equations for me. And I'm not, so instead I say, hello, Ziki. Ziki Huang is a numerical expert. He wrote H lattice. And he was kind enough to pick these equations for us and put them on his H lattice framework. So what he does is he solves for a number of k values between some lower and upper limit. The linearized?
Yeah.
Because even on the lattice, this is the easier thing to do. This is the first order approach. I'm sorry?
So why do you need to consider a lattice?
So what I mean by lattice is that it's basically solving about 80 differential equations, a grid in K. So it's saying it's solving for each for a bunch of K modes, and then interpolating those solutions to get the back reaction and putting it into the back reaction code, advancing the background one step, and then repeating the process.
If you want to consider nonlinear back reactions, then you have to renormalize the stress eigenvectors. That's a problematic business.
Right. No. This is first approach. This is the minimum to tell our story.
Okay.
So we give an initial condition of the background value at 2m, before the action really starts, some initial velocity that's coming from our estimates of the classical kicks, and then no particles. And so k equals 0 for all k. And then we treat k in a certain range between some IR cutoff and a k max. Now, k max is easy to deal with. We can just set that much, much greater than k peak. Those modes are never excited. It doesn't do anything. K min, KIR, is a more problematic issue because the results actually do depend on KIR. KIR has physical meaning. It's the longest wavelength perturbation that's treated linearly as opposed to being part of the background. So neglecting its interactions with other modes introduces errors. And so your best bet is to pick KIR just less than KP. And I'll show how the results actually depend on KIR and what parts do depend and what parts don't depend on KIR.
I think that if she's getting
we'll see. You already know that I'm not.
Oh, you're not.
Because the energy required to get beta n to k over unity is the energy that we showed already totally violates conservation of energy. So what we're going to see is high energy fraction in the modes, low n to k, which actually helps us because it puts some of this on firmer footing. We can do some of this analytically in hindsight. So, the numerical results confirm our expectations in several ways. The chameleon, the background value, does indeed just cruise in and then cruise out, nearly constant velocity. The turnaround here is very fast, and it leaves with a lower velocity than it came in with because some of that energy has been transferred to perturbation. So this shows the occupation number. It starts out way down at 10 to the minus 150. As the chameleon races in, it shoots up to about 10 to the minus 60. That's as much as it can get while still conserving energy. And then it flatlines as the chameleon rolls away and adiabaticity is restored. The spectra of the perturbations, E sub k over the total energy, is rather significant. Significant amount of energy gets transferred to the perturbations. And the spectrum, as expected, is peaked. And the location of the peak depends on the initial velocity of the field, also as we expected. And the peak is actually very well described by 1 over root 1 over delta t, as expected. But I'll point out that the occupation numbers are indeed small, which tells you that something weird is going on. The chameleon turns around much sooner than expected. So if we plot the bounce value of the chameleon, how far up the wall does it reach? The blue line shows just the expectation from the classical energy estimate. And the red dots show the numerical values. So there's a big mismatch between when we thought the chameleon was going to turn around and when it actually does turn around. And that's shown in terms of the effective mass. Remember, our naive expectation was the effective mass should shoot up to like 10 to the 17 GeV and then come back down. In reality, the mass actually stays relatively under control. It's about 30 GeV, and then comes back down. The chameleon turns around a lot sooner.
But you've done something emerging here where you have actually made some assumptions along the way, so really you know that difference is physical or processing.
Yes, because we can derive what the difference exactly is. That was a major concern. Why is it turning around so soon? We have an analytic model for exactly why that happened. The other major surprise from the numerical results was, as I mentioned earlier, the fact that they do depend on the infrared cutoff. And the reason is, if we look at how the total energy in perturbations compares to the total energy of the chameleon, what happens is that at the bounce point, all of the energy is in perturbations. And then some of that energy gets returned to the background field, and it goes stays constant after that. How much energy is returned depends on the infrared cutoff. So here I show the spectra for different values of the infrared cutoff. And you can see as I increase the infrared cutoff, the peak stays the same. We understand what caused the peak. That's delta T. The amplitude scales up almost without limit. It seems to almost reach 100%.
Sorry, E total theory is E of what?
E of the chameleon field.
Okay.
So how much initial kinetic energy did the chameleon come in with? So this is a little strange. Why does all the energy go into perturbations and then some get returned? How do you return energy to the background field?
Oh, sorry. As you make the infrared cutoff, as you make the wave number higher and higher.
As you make the infrared wave number higher and higher,
the
final energy in perturbations gets higher and higher. Less and less energy gets returned to the background of evolution. So to get a handle on
want to make it lower.
No, because remember the meaning of the IR cutoff is that it's the longest wavelength mode whose interactions are neglected. So lowering it ignores more and more interactions. It's the longest wavelength mode that's treated as a perturbation instead of as part of the background. So actually, you're neglecting, the fact that you're neglecting interactions between modes gets worse and worse as you bring KIR lower and lower.
Well, it seems that, you're making two different approximations for modes above the IR cutoff and modes below IR cutoff. So you assume the modes below IR cutoff, all their energy is this one condensate.
Exactly.
And then the modes above IR cutoff, they don't have interaction with each other.
Exactly. So the IR cutoff is an actual physical difference between how the modes are treated.
But it's not clear, you're doing better or worse if you're lowering that you're switching from one approximation to another approximation.
Absolutely. And that's why I'm going to remain very agnostic in terms of, I'm going to say it's a significant fraction of energy that gets transferred to the perturbations. I'm not going to say exactly how much. I don't think that this calculation is precise enough to be able to answer that question.
So
the question does seem to be able to answer is where is the peak? The peak is robust. So the location of the peak doesn't change at all.
So I guess, now that we're talking about this, so my first impression of seeing something like this is that why doesn't everything go into a thermal gas of chameleon particles?
Well, we'll get there. We'll get there. The question is, what kind of thermal gas?
The thing is that, there is really no easy calculation that would give you a kind of thermal distribution of any surface from a classical calculation.
The end state is highly, highly uncertain. The key feature, though, is what I'm going to be highlighting, is the energies involved in that end state, and how the energies involved in that end state actually make it asking any further questions rather moot.
Okay.
So go ahead. Go ahead.
Should I be bothered that this thing has an infrared cutoff? It's not a physical scale.
You should. Right. You should be bothered. Results that depend on the infrared cutoff, what that's saying is that our linear treatment with plus back reaction is not complete enough to really capture those things. So that's why I'm focusing on the fact of the location of the peak of the energy spectrum and not its amplitude, because the amplitude varied with the cutoff, so the fact that that amplitude I'm less certain about, the location of the peak was robust. So that I understand where that comes from, that's the delta T involved. And so that is more trustworthy. Okay, but to get at the other, at Luis's question, why is the field turning around where it is, and why does all the energy go into perturbations and some get returned? To understand that, you need to go back to the back reaction. And this is a really interesting back reaction. Let's look at this term now in terms of the Bogoliubov coefficients. And now with the benefit of hindsight, I know that beta is much, much less than 1. So I can throw away this term and just keep the first order term. Yes, I think.
If your calculation shows that everything goes into perturbation, and you did an estimate of what the scattering between two such perturbations was, the cross-section was, the rate was high relative to the Hubble rate at that time, basically it would have to be just thermalized.
Exactly. Yes. No, I agree. So to look at this back reaction a little more carefully, we can move into what's called the regime of perturbative particle production and take beta much, much less than 1 and alpha approximately equal to 1. And then we can take beta's equation of motion and just integrate it to get an expression for beta. And if we plug that back in, we get a rather interesting result, that this back reaction term is related to V triple prime phi dot, and it might even look familiar to some people. This is the exact same non-local dissipative term that was derived using in-int one-loop corrections to reheating in informalism back in 1994. So basically, we've just rediscovered the one-loop dissipative correction to the background potential. We just got at it in a different way. And this is a really weird term. It is totally non-local. It has memory of what the field used to do. We're not used to seeing that in our equations of motions. Now, because it is proportional to V triple prime squared, it's very, very peaked near the bounce. So we can just look right before the bounce. And a ways before the bounce, this quantity here is small, which means that this cosine integral here is negative. And dt basically behaves like a friction term. It's proportional to phi dot. So it slows the chameleon down. But it's not really a friction term, because phi dot appears here in the integral. So as I evolve this forward, even if phi dot is slowing, the dissipation term is not going to zero. In fact, it's more like a potential. And unlike a friction term, it can actually turn the chameleon around. Also, because of the non-locality of it, for a time after the bounce, d of t, this term here, is negative, even though the velocity is positive. Which means even though the chameleon's already rolling away, this term is pushing it, not slowing it down. And now we see why some of the energy gets returned to the background evolution. The background evolution gets accelerated by this potential shortly after the bounce. And I'm out of time, so I'm going to skip the algebra here and just say that if you go through a bunch of approximations and you do some algebraic manipulations, you can show that indeed, near the bounce, for the right instant around the bounce, this actually is a new potential related to m to the 4, which, you know, kind of reeks of Coleman-Weinberg type corrections, one-loop corrections, which is exactly what this is, with some coefficient that depends very, very weakly on both KIR and T. And so the analytics tell us that this coefficient should be somewhere between 0.02 and 0.05. It varies a little during the bounce. We want to treat it as constant, so we'll just calibrate it using the numerical results. But it's a pretty limited range. And for phi much less than m, this dissipative potential actually dominates over the chameleon potential. So it's this potential that's actually running the show. And yes, that should make you very worried, because if this correction is dominating the show, what about the other corrections that I threw away? But I'm mainly using this as an answer to Louise's questions, why we actually trust the numerical results. We do understand what's going on. With this new corrected potential, we can predict exactly when the chameleon turns around. And with the new corrected potential, we can also give a new estimate for what this delta t is, the duration of the bounce, and get a new formula for the peak wave number that is just that blue curve here. And you can show that even this very, very heuristic k peak is 1 over delta t idea actually basically gets it right. With just a little normalization, factor of order unity, we perfectly predict the location of the peak. So I don't know if you noticed where the peak was, but it's high. It's really, really high. If I go back to my velocity plot and now put it as beta and phi dot, and now ask where is the peak in the perturbation energy spectrum, because this peak is related to phi dot over m, big number, we're easily getting into energies that should make you incredibly nervous. For beta greater than 4, we're easily transplanking. For lower values of beta, we're up at 10 to the 13, 10 to the 14, 10 to the 15 GeV. That's what this story is telling us. Remember, this, and the location of the peak was totally robust to the IR cutoff. These modes are at higher energies than you ever wanted the chameleon to reach, than you ever wanted to talk about the chameleon. And so what we've basically shown here is that the chameleon is not a self-consistent low-energy field theory at all. If you just put in standard model physics, GEV scale physics, the fact that there is this extreme hierarchy of scales between, effectively, dark energy and the standard model scale makes the chameleon unstable. It makes it pushes it into energy regimes you never wanted the chameleon to go. You never wanted to trust it. The calculation goes completely out of control. The first one loop correction is dominating the calculation, which means the 2, 3, 4 loop corrections have to be worse. The interactions between the modes are huge. And this is all happening, I say, in the early universe, but by especially early universe cosmology standards, not really all that early. This is happening at 10, 1.1 GeV, and even during BBN for some of these values. So that's my conclusion, that this is a chameleon catastrophe, that we've shown that when you kick a chameleon, it hits its bare potential at a fatal velocity and then shatters into high-energy particles that you never, ever should trust your theory at. And I'm out of time, so I won't go through the summary and just ask if there are any further questions. Thanks.
So supposing you did trust the theory up to these, suppose you said, actually the chameleon theory is...
If I hold my nose and push on, yes.
Yeah. Then what is the so the energy density in those perturbations, like let's say 70% of the energy goes into these perturbations.
Absolutely.
70% in the background. And those perturbations dilute away a lot faster than the background.
Yes, they dilute away as radiation.
Today you kind of have a uniform background of chameleons.
Absolutely. I think the more concern would be BBN. That gas would still be present during BBN. It's highly inhomogeneous, highly energetic, and it couples to matter. So basically, you're right that the present-day chameleon.
Sorry, why is it highly inhomogeneous?
Because it's got these high momenta, high frequency perturbation modes.
Yeah, but it's a type of inhomogeneity that you would never see. So.
It's very, 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 very small scale.
So why
but it's but it's well, it's huge excursions. It does couple the matter. So I think it would transfer some of this very high energy to matter. I don't know if that would lift the temperature during BBN, but I think it would probably stir up the matter in some way, because the chameleon does directly couple the matter. So these perturbations do couple the matter. The perturbations also self-interact, and we don't know exactly how that's going to go.
Again, it seems like an interesting thing to do would be to just roughly speaking, estimate the self-interaction and see if they thermalize, and you know their energy, mm-hmm. You'll know do they thermalize with ordinary matter or not, just roughly speaking. Like what's the biggest interaction cross-section with nucleons?
No, I see
Do they thermalize before or after BBN?
I'm a little hesitant to see the value of that calculation, frankly, though. Because you're still trusting the chameleon. Basically, I trust these results up to the bounce.
Up to
the bounce. After the bounce, what this is telling you is that your background evolution of the chameleon, your background equation for the chameleon, is completely wrong. The one loop, two loop, three loop, four loop corrections, you've lost all perturbative control, even the background evolution of the chameleon. That's what this is telling you. And you also, your modes now are at energies where you never ever wanted to trust what the chameleon potential was doing. You never thought that steep part of the potential should reach that high. Sure, you can forge ahead and continue to ask questions, but I'm not really convinced those questions actually have any physical meaning, because they're working with a theory that's already been shown to kind of have self-destructed, that it's not viable anymore.
It's not the theory that's self-destructive, it's the calculation that's self-destructive.
You were far away from the regime where you thought you could trust the theory.
It's the calculation. So you can never, for example, there is no perturbative calculation that can take a non-thermal gas and take it to a condensate and take it to a thermal gas. That doesn't mean that that doesn't happen. It's just that there's no simple perturbative calculator that does this for you.
I understand that, but
she means the part about exciting modes way above the.
Yeah, but I mean, that doesn't say that there is anything wrong. I mean, okay, so maybe you don't trust this theory at those energies, but then that doesn't rule out the theory.
But I think it does show that you need a theory, you need to take this theory and embed it into something you do trust to those energies. And then, once you do that, then you can start doing the calculations that you were suggesting later. But the naive theory, at the base level, what we know is that the background equation is totally wrong. The background equation, the one loop, two loop, three loop corrections to the background equation are completely dominated. So we don't have a background equation anymore.
I agree with you. But again, it doesn't necessarily say that all is lost, because if indeed these particles are strongly interacting, then all that can happen is make a thermal gas, and the only thing that fixes the temperature is the energy that you had in phi dot to begin with, and it was subdominant, so it will remain subdominant. And the temperature would then therefore be less than, the temperature of the universe, right?
Well, the temperature, I mean, the momenta, you know, the temperature of the gas would, if it thermalized in the high energy mode, some got to cascade down.
Right,
yes,
exactly.
It would be a gas.
Indeed, we don't understand how the cascade happens, but if basically attractions are strong, we know that the cascade should happen, and then you end up with a thermal gas in low temperature.
And then I would say that we still don't know what the background evolution of the field is. We don't know if the field, we don't know where the minimum of the field is, we don't know if the field stayed at its minimum, so this idea that then that gas gets diluted away, we don't know what the background did during that. Did it roll back out to high values and get stuck again, which would screw up BBN? Did it? Did the field, you know, roll up and then roll back out again and get stuck again? We don't have a background equation anymore to solve this theory, so we can't really answer that. We can't even talk about what the homogeneous background is doing. So Ron, I'm not here to say that I wish I could, and for a long time that was the goal of this project, was to be able to point to an observation and say, see, the chameleon doesn't do this. We can't do that. The best I can tell you is that chameleon gravity isn't self-consistent. It can't, if you put low energy physics in, you get terribly high energy physics out. And so if we want to take chameleon gravity seriously as an alternative to GR, we need to embed it. I see you shaking your head. No, we don't. But we need to embed it into something that we actually trust up to transplanckian energies. And, you know, I wish anybody motivated to do that the best of luck.
Why don't I just build a noose around my neck?
All right. Well, unless there are any more questions, let's thank you for